Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm your host, Tammy Haddad. You're about to hear a conversation that was recorded at PubKey in Washington, D.C., featuring founders of cybersecurity companies whose clients spanned government, military, and everyday consumers. A special thanks to our partners at General Catalyst Institute.
So let's get started. Brian Dye. He's CEO of CoreLife, the open network detection and response platform. His security career includes stints at Symantec, McAfee, Citrix, meaning he's had a front row view of every era of cyber defense. Let's give a big welcome. Okay. David Gary is CEO of Buckground, which is the pioneer of crowdsourced security that connects organizations with trusted hackers. Trusted hackers. Okay, we'll find out about that in a minute. Welcome, Dave. Thank you for being here. And right next to me is Sam Jones, CEO, co-founder of Method Security, which builds autonomous cyber systems for government, Department of War, several Fortune 500 companies. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran and a Palantir veteran. Welcome, welcome. Thank you for your service. Thanks for being here. Okay, Sam, I'm going to start with you. We're in the post-Mythos era. What is going on? What are you worried about? And what are you planning for?
Well, I think the headline right now, the way that we see the world, is American cyber dominance has never been so important. That's essentially what we started this company for. And we're all going to share our different perspectives on how we're tackling that problem. But the problem that we see in the market and the industry right now is that every board of directors is asking one question of their CISO for the first time ever, which is really exciting for the security industry. And that is, what is my enterprise readiness against a Mythos-equipped and compute-equipped adversary that wants to do damage to my business? And if I am not ready, what am I going to do about it? That's on kind of the business defensive side. On the more national offensive side, every cyber offensive operator that's doing God's work in some windowless basement right now is asking, how do I employ these models at scale to defeat and deter my adversaries? And how can I do in a way that I can govern my system and own my own destiny? Those are very hard technical problems, which we'll get into. AI is an ingredient to accomplishing that, but if we solve those problems, we can solve American cyber dominance.
I like AI as an ingredient as opposed to the general at our AI honors dinner that called it ranch dressing. He said AI was ranch dressing. I like that better. CoreLife grew out of an open source project. What does that give you in security that proprietary approaches cannot match?
Ranch dressing.
There you go. I think it's an obvious answer.
More seriousness, being open source is incredibly unusual as a business model. It's incredibly unusual in cybersecurity. You can count on one hand the number of companies that have come out of that world, but you can also look at the yield and the success rate of those companies, which is dramatically high. And why is that? It's because you get distributed innovation, right? The open source project that we came out of is in the web scale tech giants. It's in the high end of DHS. It's in the high end of the DOW. And what you get from that is you get incredibly elite defenders who are investigating the nation state attacks, the post-Mythos attacks, exactly as Dan was saying. And they're finding, oh, here's the new data I need to investigate this threat and prosecute this threat. That feedback then gets back into the project, gets added in. Now you've got a better data set to be able to go and investigate the next set of attacks. So that flywheel has been happening for over 20 years, and it's not a theoretical thing. You've got folks from Salesforce, Amazon, MITRE, CISA, that have all contributed either detection content or new data types directly into the project. So you get this community that's creating a data set by security experts for security experts, and that's something that no one vendor can replicate.
Okay, so Dave, I know you love the hackers.
We love hackers. I think so often hacker has this negative connotation that these are the hoodie-wearing people in a basement doing criminal action, right? And that couldn't be farther from the truth. We do a survey every year called our Inside the Mind of the Hacker Report. 3/4 of our population in the community, this is 700,000 people all around the world, they're working full-time in cyber. Right? This is a side hustle for them. So what does it allow us to do by partnering with them is we can bring the world's best and brightest talent that our customers otherwise never would have access to. These are military operators. These are full-time CISOs. These are security engineers that you would never be able to hire or keep employed. You can now bring them for exactly the right use case at exactly the right time to solve whatever cyber challenge you're having in the moment.
Wow. Okay. So you've got cyber and you've got hackers. and then you got AI. So how has AI changed the hacker scenario?
So it's changed a lot. The skill set of the hackers has changed. Now, instead of just looking for traditional security vulnerabilities, they're leveraging AI safety flaws. They're looking at how can we find misuse within systems. We look at the results coming in on our platform. We're seeing 334% more vulnerabilities flowing through our platform today because they're generated by AI. So what that's allowed these human researchers to do is act at machine speed. The attacker is already doing this. For years, there has been automation and scripting and everything else being done both on the defensive side and the offensive side. Now we're able to harness that on behalf of customers to help them keep pace with the attacker. The attacker is going to use the tools that are readily available to them. We're simply putting it back in the hands of the defender and helping the hacker community operate at scale.
Okay, but let's go back to trusted hacker. How do you make someone a trusted hacker?
So any customer that comes to us that says, well, we couldn't possibly work with hackers. Guess what? You already are. You just don't know it.
Did you tell Sean Karen Cross that? Did you call the White House and say you're working with these guys, buddy?
I will tell you, the federal government has been a fantastic partner for years because they're seeing the positive results that come through working with this hacker community. So how do we make sure that they're trusted? Well, first of all, our job isn't to police the internet. There's always going to be bad people on the internet. Our job is to make sure that when we bring somebody to bear for our customer, there's somebody that can be trusted. So we look at things like KYC checks, OFAC sanction checks, right? We're making sure that before we're paying somebody, we know who they are, we know that they're able to be paid by a US entity, and ultimately making sure that they're doing the right things for our customers. The hackers on our platform don't get any special credentials, they don't get special access. So it would be the equivalent, the analogy I like to use is if I was gonna go rob a bank, I'm not. If I was gonna go rob a bank, I'm not signing up for a bank account first. That doesn't get me anything. Them joining our platform doesn't get them special access. And we just make sure that, again, as we're working with the community, as soon as we identify that somebody's misbehaving, they're not following the rules of engagement, they're not following what the customers asked for, they're kicked off the platform, they're banned, and we don't work with them again.
All right, Sam, let me come back to you. What is something the national security community understands about cyber that the commercial world doesn't know or understand?
I'm going to give a truth and a misconception for both markets, actually.
Oh, please, if please, that's okay. Feel free.
The truth is that I think both markets understand that AI is a completely, by itself, untrustworthy technical resource. You cannot trust AI to like create any key business decision without any other protections around that in terms of a system. Nowhere is this more true than cyber, where it's, you know, no fail, you must be correct, especially in different forms of offense. I think the misconception that both the government and commercial have in some regards there is because this is untrustworthy, we cannot use it in production operations. Mm-hmm. That is actually false. You're capable to use this as a technical resource in a larger system of systems that is enforcing guardrails, rules of engagement, ensuring deterministic checks, and keeping the cyber operator in the loop at all times. I think nowhere is this more apparent or less understood, especially post-Mythos, where it was claimed that this is somehow this cyber weapon off the shelf, which is not true, by the way. It can be used and harnessed to be a cyber weapon, but alone it is not. But that these national offensive cyber missions, both from a like Title 10, Title 50 perspective, but also red teaming one's own organization from a commercial perspective, is possible with complete trust and sovereignty. I think that's a misconception the market has on both sides right now that would be better to be well understood, especially from those that are pushing a certain fear narrative, mm-hmm. so that we can actually then employ these technologies more at scale to actually solve the root of the problem, which is we need to re-secure ourselves very rapidly.
How do you fix that, Sam, the narrative?
Proof, results, I think is the most important thing. And then for the companies like us, we ultimately serve a persona. For us, it's the operator and really delivering to the human that is ultimately responsible, making them the hero, and then letting them tell their story. And I think that will change that narrative.
Okay, Brian, you've had a long career across major security vendors. What is the biggest thing enterprises consistently get wrong about detection and response?
I think there's what we've gotten wrong historically and how much more important that is in a post-Mythos world. Because if you think about what we're getting wrong, You know, first off, huge credit to everybody at MITRE who's helped create and mature the attack framework so folks can at least have a common language to work through all this. I think it's fantastic. But the first thing that people get wrong is they think, oh, in this particular TTP, I have a detection. That means I'm covered. No, you're not. You're not assessing depth of that coverage. So that's the number one thing we're getting wrong. The number two thing we're getting wrong is we don't consider anomalies in our coverage. There's a whole bunch of things that don't fit within classic frameworks. That doesn't mean they're not threats. That means that's a creative adversary. And the third thing is we don't consider threat hunting a necessary part of our detection coverage because you have to understand your environment to be able to differentiate between a truly novel threat versus just some aberrant part of your operation. So it really is those three things. We got to look at the actual depth of the detection coverage. We have to look at anomalies and we have to consider threat hunting in what we're doing because we're looking for the unknown. That's a big part of this.
I like that threat hunting. The truth is everything has changed so much and there's so much fear that if you don't find a way for people to actually look at things, I just don't know how you're going to be able to accomplish what you want and keep people safe, either in the government or private industry. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I would completely agree. I think what we have proven is that vulnerability detection is now the easy part. The days of just assuming that's boring, nobody's going to pay attention to it, it's legacy tech, those days are gone because now AI is going to go scan that at all times. So Brian's exactly right that if you don't have strong threat hunting, if you're not actively looking for what's around the next corner, if you're not actively searching your own environment, if you don't even know what your environment is, right? There's still customers that we go in and talk to that don't even understand what assets they have, what they've deployed, their shadow IT. We heard a lot around shadow AI, right? We're seeing this play out more and more. If you don't even know what that is, if you're not proactively looking for it.
What do you call shadow AI?
Very simply, every enterprise has authorized some tool for AI. It's all the employees that then say, well, on my personal device, I have Claude, I have ChatGPT, I have all these things. They start using that to become more productive at work. It's great. You become more efficient. But now are you putting sensitive company information in? Are you sharing customer data? Are you sharing financial data? Are you linking your calendar, your email, whatever else? Because yeah, it makes you a lot more productive. But was that something that's been tested and vetted by your team?
You guys are scaring me. All right, Sam.
There's a positive message in here, for
okay,
sure.
Okay, I'm waiting for
We can win.
Okay, based on what you heard at your meetings with GCI, to the extent you can inform us, where do you think Washington is getting cybersecurity policy? Now we're talking about the government again. And where is it moving too slowly? What's your message tomorrow on the Hill?
Well, I think one thing that was just really encouraging to all of us is that there is a strong bipartisanship agreement that this is a critical national problem and we need to address it and we need to address it as a whole of government. I think what the government is getting right now is the folks on the different security subcommittees are super technical. They are very competent and they are passionate about this and they're going to do the right thing for America. Now, there's a lot of details to translate. I would say where things get hard, at least in my experience, is you have, you know, congressional authority, you have executive orders and they all sound and feel good. But then once it hits the middle upper management of time to like, let's go implement this thing. That is where we fall short. So we need to rethink how industry and government work together to solve some of those problems. But I left today very encouraged. And I think there's no more exciting time or important time to work in security right now.
And you worked at Palantir and you're saying that. My God. Okay, last question for you guys. What keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night is the fact that folks are over hoping. We're hoping too much about what AI will do for us. And we're not thinking enough about the data that the AI needs to do that job. We're betting on the car with no gas in the tank. So that's what keeps me up at night.
Okay, well, what do you mean by that? That people don't have control of their personal data or where it's coming from or how it's being processed?
Think about the difference between what your AI tool can do for you if you're just randomly using ChatGPT, I'll say, versus if ChatGPT is tied to all the other data you have. If you're in a corporate environment, your Slack, your email, your files, everything else, it's radically more effective if it has access to the data to make useful decisions and make those constructive kind of conclusions. But we're all thinking about the models. We're not thinking enough about what data does the model need to get to the answers and the business results and the cybersecurity improvements that I need.
Okay, we'll get the next panel to fix that. Dave.
So I think very simply for me, it's critical infrastructure. We are so woefully underprepared for a mass scale attack when it comes to critical infrastructure, and there's no single agency responsible for it.
We see it pop up in different agencies. Everybody cares. Everybody wants to fix it. But there's not a combined effort on, okay, this is what we need to do. This is how we're going to go fix it. And I think we are going to, unfortunately, eventually learn the hard way that that was something that was amiss for us. So that's the number one thing that as we go in, whether it's telecommunications, whether it's the grid, whether it's other energy infrastructure, water, we are so woefully underprepared for a mass scale attack.
Sam?
I think cyber is the most important warfighting domain of the 21st century, but it is also the warfighting domain in which America has the smallest advantage gap. Any other domain, America essentially dominates, but it is very asymmetric in cyber. Anyone internet connected can essentially challenge us. And I worry about that gap. I worry about that asymmetry. I think we have the best people in the world to do it, but we need to make them superhuman and get out of their way.
Is it fixable in the short term?
Yes. We have all the tools. We have all the people. I think we just need to figure out some of the tech authorities, technologies, bureaucracies, and go win.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for being here. That's terrific. We're going to let you go. I have a couple questions for the audience while our other guests come up. We make you work here at the Washington AI Network. So the question is, a show of hands from the audience, who here thinks their personal data is already compromised? Oh my God, everyone, this is such a sophisticated group. Arjun, I'm so glad you're here. You guys got to fix this. Let me do the official introductions and then we're going to get some answers to this. All right, Arjun, I'm going to start with you. Arjun Bhatnagar, CEO of Cloak, the privacy-first company that lets people control their personal data with masked identities and AI-powered protection. Arjun, welcome.
Thank you.
Come on, Jais. He's going to help you with your personal data. Come on, give him a big welcome. Aida Baradari, founder of Davalence, super cool name, whose debut device, Spectre, won So James Bond. It's so good. Let's hear for her. Just come on. That's so great. It's designed to stop nearby microphones from recording your conversations. Welcome. Thank you so much. Okay, and Bill Robbins, right next to me here, CEO of Menlo Security, the browser security leader protecting over 8 million daily users, including 8 of the 10 largest banks. Let's get to business because this is some really serious stuff. What are we going to do about these data issues? What do you do?
I think there's two things. One is there's ongoing, and I know Arjun's going to talk about this. There's education, there's training, there's trying to make people aware of the problem that exists. I think that's partially effective. More importantly, we need two things. We need technology that's going to protect, and that's ever evolving in a world of AI where the threat is literally changing by the day. That's going to require industry to think differently. Secondly, we need public policy that's going to help drive that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's get these people to work. Okay, Arjun, you're up.
Yeah, so I think data always comes down to, well, we talk about how do we build a stronger fence, but in reality, it's a question of control. When we talk about sharing everything about you, and I can say this for everybody here, I can tell everybody in this audience their social security number in 5 seconds. And it's possible because one data point can expose everything about you. So it becomes a question of control and how do you establish that? And can we give defensive capabilities to everyday individuals? That's at least where we're fighting.
Okay, it gets it started. Aida, what about you? Where are you on this?
Definitely same as with both of these gentlemen. I would say that we need to build more tools to prevent unwanted data collection and also the misuse of that data. So even if data is recorded or stored in some way, we need to find ways in which we can prevent that data from being misused. So I would say that is the mission of all of the companies that we're building and overall a larger mission for what we see as a future for American citizens.
So tell us about some of the tools that you guys are building.
Yeah, so for us, as you mentioned, Spectre One, which was actually inspired by the James Bond movie.
So cool.
I'm glad you caught that, is a product, a device that prevents microphones from recording you. So it's really for three different groups. One, people who deal with confidential information in their everyday lives. They are at higher risk of being compromised, of their devices being hijacked and them being recorded. Then also it is for regular Americans, for American families who have smart devices and also smart home devices, right? So we've seen, for example, a $95 million settlement from Apple around 2 years ago, a $68 million settlement on Google Assistant side, where there is a lot of false activations of these assistants. And we see that that data then actually gets labeled. So there's people who do listen in to these conversations, and that is, of course, not wanted. And lastly, it is also looking ahead into the future of AI recorders and ambient AI, so more and more AI being integrated in our lives, not really knowing when they are listening and when we're really having a conversation that's transcribed.
People don't even think twice about any of this anymore. So you guys have a heavy lift. Okay, Bill, the browser has become where we work, bank, shop, everything. And you call it the most dangerous piece of software. What do we do about it?
The browser is the new OS. We all used to use Windows or Apple iOS, and all of our applications were on our endpoint. Today, we do everything in the cloud. How do we access that? We go through a browser that makes a connectivity. And that's true whether you're a human or in a new world of agentic AI, if you're an agent doing work on behalf of humans. Because that's where so many actions are happening, it basically increases the threat landscape, the attack surfaces become bigger, and bad guys, if nothing else, go to where the easy money is. They always have in history, they always will. So they've targeted that point of interaction. And if that's not secure, if you're going out to a website and you don't have security from the browser, you can be compromised. You can be compromised through a social engineering attack. You can be compromised through SQL injection, malware. You mentioned the fact we do a lot of business with banks. Our single largest customer is the Department of War. We protect 3.3 million warfighters and employees every single day. What that means is every time one of those employees goes out to a public internet, they're protected by our technology. How do we do that? We basically create a virtualized browser session that makes it physically impossible for malware, for SQL injections, for bad things to go from that browser session down to the user's endpoint. I've been doing security for 20 some odd years. It's always been a detect and respond model. With the advent of AI and near instantaneous threats, prevention is going to matter one hell of a lot more than detection.
Arjun, how do you talk to people to get them to focus on this?
It's a really interesting point. We're a business that's consumer, enterprise, we're tackling right. The whole thing. And the first part I start is people actually do care. We have 92% of America is upset or angry.
But they don't know what to do.
They don't know what to do.
Right.
And so you have to simplify the problem. The way we look at this is that, well, my information is out there. People can find out where I live or my family is. I get spam phone calls. You start with an issue of safety. So is it personal safety, family safety, financial fraud? Is it spam, scam, or phishing, or is it surveillance? One of those three categories resonates with every human on earth. You'd be like, oh, I'm getting all these scam phone calls, like that annoys me. Latch there and start the journey. Or they're deep in the privacy rabbit hole, and they're saying, I'm being surveilled. How do I stop people tracking me everywhere? So there is a messaging that's starting to be effective. Your story has to match the audience first, but the solution is the same. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't change my passwords. You're speaking Greek to me. I don't know how you get the whole world to pay attention enough. Aida, where have you found success in getting that message out? I mean, on the technical side, I don't mean, you know, on TV.
I actually think about this a lot because what we see in general in the technology space is that there's this discrepancy between people wanting convenience and at the same time also freedom, of course, right? These are fundamental values that are core to who we are, at least in this country. So what we found that is really, really important for people is seeing these technologies being built that try to bridge the two, that you don't have to choose, like, I need to do all these inconvenient things, but instead I can enjoy the benefits of technology and at the same time be assured that my freedom is protected and my privacy is protected as well. So I would say that's a messaging that has been very well received.
Okay, so Bill, phishing. I mean, you're talking about the browser, but phishing has been going on forever, since the beginning of the internet. I don't know how you get rid of it. And I don't know how you, again, I'm sorry, I'm a broken record, but change the point of view at the same time.
Yeah, training and awareness and understanding the problem is important. But to your point, organizations have been doing training for the last 30 years, and it's statistically proven. You do a training session, and within 2 weeks, you can send out phishing attacks, you know, internally as a test, and 30% of the people will click on them, right? They're just wired to do that, especially if it's a well-designed phishing attack. So I think training is an important part of it, but this goes back to why I said prevention is going to be so important. Being able to prevent and eliminate phishing attacks or malware or whatever the threat may be at time of execution, as opposed to counting on a human to do the right thing and then counting on a SOC to detect it and then counting on someone to go remediate it. In a world of AI where agents are doing that in milliseconds, it's yesterday's model. Tomorrow's model is going to be all about prevention.
Okay, Arjun, what advice would you give founders building in cybersecurity today that you wish someone had told you when you started?
Oh, when I started? Interesting. So someone building cybersecurity, there's simple core tenets that I think around, at least where we're building in, and it kind of resonates with everyone who's already spoken today. You are trying to build pillars to create, obviously, not just a line of defense, but now a line of offense. It has to be when you have real-time attacks, you're building a defensive play and offensive play. I say these three Ds, degrade, deny, deflect. These principles as you're building, how do you create technology that allows for this? I'm in personal cyber, which is also a very interesting space, which there's nobody in. But in corporate cyber, the attacks are so wide, you have to have really built a system that's both self-learning and self-attacking. And so that's something I think about from the enterprise side. We're bringing that same principle to consumer and personal, but both personal and enterprise are thinking around, what is my perimeter? And it's getting wider and wider. So you want to find that gap in the perimeter. For me, it's personal perimeter. And that applies for businesses and it does for people. How are you protecting the people in your organization? But I think as the browsers, I think about networks, even listening, that perimeter is getting wider. If people are bringing AI note takers to everything, well, then now how do you defend against that? So identify that perimeter and defend against it and also create the offensive capabilities.
So in Washington, there's all these conversations about the stack, right? The telecommunications system, every piece of it, data centers. And the fact that people have knowledge of it, but don't see a solution, you're going to go up to Congress tomorrow and you're going to say, here's A, B, C, D, E, to get them to focus on it. But again, if you don't have people at home and if you don't have companies or people who are willing to invest the money, because this isn't free. So if you want to say to someone, in a way, it's kind of like when you have to replace, you know, your faucet in the sink that used to spray all over and do 25 things and now it only does two. Do I want to pay for that? Or do I want to pay for this? Again, I keep coming back to talking folks into this is something that you need to do, but you need to do it in advance.
You have to activate. It's absolutely right. The case. But the good thing, I think, is cyber is an everybody problem. So it's not just the IT folks, security, everyone's now involved. The good thing is people are aware, they're not aware of the solutions, but they are itching and you tap the right energy, they'll act. But now becomes our job to figure out how you tap into that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this question is for all of you. If you could get a consumer to do one thing to help themselves, what would it be? What would you tell them to do? Aida, I'm going to start with you.
I would say educate yourself and also reflect on your own technological habits. There's a lot more data that we give up in just normal ways of interacting with our phones than we might realize. So really reflecting on what our habits are and what we do to prevent that from happening is important. Of course, inform yourselves of the people who are building tools to prevent that from happening. And lastly, I would say there's a whole new effort that is coming along, I feel like, with the rise of AI to make sure that systems are becoming more safe. So looking at those resources is also really good for your own awareness. So you know, when am I being influenced? How can I protect myself?
We don't usually talk about safety here in Washington, D.C. Arjun, what's your answer?
Well, I talk about this a lot. Yeah. I work also with consumers. And that is like so many tips. The first thing I say is start with no. I think the principle of no is a really key thing to look at. If you go to TSA and you stand in front of their camera technology and says, hey, stand there because I have to show my face. If you say no, nothing changes. They say, give me your license. They look at it and you go through forward. That applies also to technology, applies to AI. Don't share every piece of data for a new app, a new technology. Start with no and start to give gradually. As a kind of reference about data, data is the main thing everyone's very hungry about and they want to collect to harvest and index on. So if you start with no, you'll be surprised that the experience doesn't change. You can hit airplane mode on Google Maps and actually still get home. And so the reality is that they want to gobble your street data. Everybody wants to grab all information. And we talk about U.S. companies, but obviously adversaries abroad, they're targeting our companies to get that information. So start minimal and then build from that point on.
Arjun, I think you need a top 10 list.
Oh, I have a top 10
things to, okay, yeah. We'll get that later. All right, Bill.
Yeah, I find saying no at TSA gets me strip searched, but
I was going to say, that sounds a little scary, yeah. But it is true. You do not have to,
you don't have to
allow the photo.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in jest, right? Advice, move to Utah, live in a box canyon in a bunker, disconnect, and with AI, we're all going to die, right? I mean, there's a balance of what you do. Seriously, to his point, and frankly, something you said earlier, if I was talking to my mom or my 21-year-old daughter, same thing, change your passwords, don't write them down, and seriously, use multi-factor authentication. As a consumer doing business, our accounts, everything that's important to us, those are probably the two strongest things you can do because your data is going to be out there. You should be thoughtful about what you put out there, but protecting it with some very basic hygiene is probably the most simplistic, safe thing you can do. It's not a panacea for everything, but it's a great start.
Well, the multi-factor authentication is on everything now. Can people not use it? I mean, you have to use it.
A lot of companies still don't force or mandate multi-factor authentication. Changing passwords, exactly. That's the second tip I get into. But the problem is you say change passwords. You have 150 passwords because you're really bad. You have one password for everything. I say change 5 passwords. You don't need to change 100 passwords.
That's a good
you
idea.
You change 5.
Yeah.
It's your email. It's mm-hmm. your Apple/Google account. It's mm-hmm. your carrier. Bonus points for locking your SIM. Mm-hmm. It's your computer password. Do not use the same password you use online for your computer. And then also one of the most often accounts you use. If it is Sephora, then lock down that Sephora account. It's 5 accounts you use. That is really moves the needle way more. Because if you make the ask really big, be really good at cyber, everyone struggles. Now, we try to automate it for you, but ultimately, if you're doing it on your own, starting a little bit, you're talking about outrunning a bear. When you're talking about how do you actually outrun someone else, you are actually now way ahead of everyone.
You know, it's curious, as an online shopper, it makes you think about security, right? All the rules are completely different. Why isn't there some sort of set of rules? I don't mean government, but just, you know, here's 5 things that you should do, because you can tell it's not the same kind of security.
I think there are a number of kind of public policy, not necessarily government, public policy organizations that do put out rules. Like, here are best practices. I think it's kind of human nature to ignore those, to just think, I've got to move fast. I want those new pair of shoes, baby.
Right.
Whatever it is, right? You don't think about implementing all those controls. They are out there. Maybe we could do a better job as industry of pushing them a little bit harder.
Okay. Well, the 3 of you, I can't thank you enough. This has been incredible. Let's say thank you, please. Join me in thanking them so much. And I appreciate all your tips. And I want everyone to change a password right now. Thank you for joining the Washington AI Network. We're here at PubKey with General Catalyst Institute and these incredible founders. You can't talk enough to the policymakers here. They care. They're engaged. Don't believe what you hear. It's terrific you're here tonight. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.